On first glance, June Tenmull's order paper looked to offer little opportunity for political excitement. As it turned out, there was plenty to exercise our MHKs increasingly mindful of the 2026 general election. There were questions about the quality of childcare and protection. Was political messaging around the TT adequate? Should we consider whether things are ethically okay and not just legally sound? Securing funding for the family library was discussed, as was the law governing employment of children. First up, Alf Cannon, Chief Minister. You had a few questions to answer in Tynwald. The first was a starred question from Julie Edge, and this was in relation to the Everil inquiry into the care of young people. Now, that was quite an old inquiry. Why was it being raised, do you think?
I'm not sure exactly what the specific motivation is, but you know, absolutely happy to answer questions on it. I think it's very important that we're fully on top of what we are doing in terms of the delivery of children and families services. I think you know, what came out clearly was that the initial report was back in 2006, and you know, it was effectively closed off as a formal sort of reporting on recommendations by council ministers in 2013. So it's been some substantial time. But as I was keen to highlight today, that report had 120 or so recommendations. There was a significant amount of work. It was done on, you know, the back of the unfortunate incident, and the murder of two children in care. And, you know, the resultant implications from that and what we needed to do as a government and as a community in terms of improving the access to care and how we were monitoring it and managing it. Look, things have moved on considerably since then. I think I was able to highlight the two strategic plans that had been brought forward subsequent to that. Indeed, the most recent, there was an Ofsted review and a number of improvements were made, you know, since then. So, look, important subject and, you know, hopefully I provided some reassurance around that, but nevertheless, it does stem back to a fairly substantial piece of work that was delivered, albeit 12 years ago now.
And are you convinced that we have in place the necessary policies, procedures, support, legislation to ensure that young people in the Isle of Man are as well protected as they possibly can be?
Well, we invest a lot of time, effort and money into this area, and you know, we've set up a number of multi-agencies. You know, that isn't just the responsibility of one person or one board. I think you know, we're very clear that safeguarding is everybody's business. That's certainly the mantra that we take forward, and it's important, of course, that it isn't, as I said, just about one department. You know, this is involves multi-departments, particularly, of course, Manx Care, Social Services, the Department of Education, Sport and Culture, Home Affairs. Everybody's got a role to play. So there is a lot of multi-agency coordination needed. And I think Home Affairs Minister answered a question on this subject last week in the House of Keys, and we will be bringing forward some more plans as to how we can improve that multi-agency link.
Do you think sometimes, and maybe this isn't just limited to child services, that maybe we're too interested in providing the evidence that we've dealt with a particular case appropriately? So we end up with lots and lots of boxes to tick and paperwork generated, and that possibly takes more of the focus of officers than perhaps getting on with the real sort of coalface work that is so essential.
Well, it's absolutely important that we have the right governance around this, and we're confident that we are getting the right governance and the right paperwork is being filled in. I mean, it's hugely important that we have that safeguard, but equally, you know, actually demonstrating the impact of the work that takes place at the coalface is really important. So, you know, there was a new initiative launched last year, which was about really giving children the best opportunity, particularly looked after children, and trying to get them back reintegrated into the home environment. So at that time, there were 87 children in care. There's 85 children as at today. And indeed, you know, five children actually over the last 12 months have been returned from care back to the home environment. Now, that's the sort of success you're never really going to hear about. It's not the type of work that attracts headlines. But, you know, we're taking it very seriously and, you know, I listed out a huge number of improvements that have been made in terms of the delivery of children's and family services since 2023.
Moving on then to, there were several other questions, but there was one from Joni Farragher, which was in relation to F-35 fighter jet parts being exported from the Isle of Man and eventually ending up in Israel. Joni Farragher was making the point that sometimes what's legally okay may not be ethically okay. Did she have a point?
Look, I think we should be very proud of our manufacturing industry. I think I'm very clear to highlight that, you know, we've got 1,200 people employed directly in this industry, never mind everybody around in those sort of supporting services, but 1,200 people delivering precision parts for a range of global businesses and a range of global contracts. You know, we cannot just, as a small island, pick and choose which global contracts we enter into. We do have an export control. That export control board is in the United Kingdom, and we need those licenses to partake in these international programs, particularly in defense programs. And, you know, it's not something that the government is just pick and choose. You could imagine the chaos and lack of certainty for manufacturing if they thought the Isle of Man government was just going to start picking and choosing which particular projects we were happy ethically to support and we weren't ethically to support. So it's a much, much bigger picture than that. And I think we should be proud of what we do on the Isle of Man, and cognizant of the fact that, you know, we're just not big enough to start making decisions like that if we want to have stability in our industries, and that, you know, those sort of export matters are at a global level. We have small businesses involved in global supply chains, you know, and we need to approach that with a level of maturity and responsibility.
There are, though, many countries around the world, as well as the United Nations, that are suggesting that Israel certainly has a case to answer in relation to breaking the international rules that govern the way in which countries should behave. In those circumstances, should there not be some sort of mechanism in place that says, actually, we shouldn't be supporting a country that potentially is breaking the rules?
Well, the United Kingdom made a decision in September 2024 to stop arms exports to Israel. And clearly, if we had precision parts being manufactured in that particular area, then ultimately our businesses will be part of that compliance process with those regulations or with those orders that have been brought forward. As I said, Phil, we need to have a sensible level of maturity and recognition and cognizance about our overall role in the supply chain here, and, you know, the recognition that actually, you know, whilst we all have made differing views about specific wars or events that are taking place around the globe, if we want stability, economic stability for the manufacturing sector and for any sector, that we've got to take a mature global approach to that, and that means, you know, respecting the United Kingdom's position on defence and on foreign affairs.
Moving on then to a matter much closer to home, and that was the TT. At one point, I think you were, I think it was you, made a sort of a tongue-in-cheek comment about not being able to deal with the weather. It might have been the Enterprise Minister. Tim Glover, though, was asking some reasonable questions here in relation to government's message to visitors to the TT. Do you think that perhaps next year there could be greater engagement from government?
Look, I think the government takes its responsibility seriously in these matters. You know, obviously we've had a A few questions about safety messaging, but you've seen that messaging in terms of the safety messaging, healthcare messaging that is given out to fans, advisory messaging around, things about road and road safety. So there is a lot of messaging that does come out from the government. I think Mr. Glover is, particularly when he was speaking to me, was talking about, perhaps he felt that there was a lack of actual visual political engagement in terms of a welcome and a goodbye from senior political figures. Look, I think these things have to be taken in balance. We must message with relevance. We have a diverse audience visiting the Isle of Man during the TT. I think absolutely we need to balance sort of friendly messaging, if you like, of welcomes and thank you very much, with also, the relevance of ensuring that they are listening to those messages that are hugely important about, road safety or healthcare delivery or specific events that are taking place, because there's a lot to take in over a very busy fortnight. But we'll take on board what Mr. Glover's view was and, put it to the teams that are organising the TT as to whether actually there could be more political interface, but it's got to be in balance.
And I guess if there was more political interface from government, then there would be arguments that this was purely electioneering, particularly because next year's TT will be just before the election.
Absolutely. You can see I'm smirking, but it's as I said, in all seriousness, it just needs to be done in balance. Is there a case for, the Chief Minister to be on a screen on the steam packet saying welcome to our island and have a safe and pleasant journey, and equally be shown, thank you very much for visiting the island. Some people would argue yes. There's probably quite a lot of people that say no, we don't need the Chief Minister talking to TT visitors. Actually, we need them to have proper safety information and detailed information about what they are seeing and need to know about their visit on in terms of specifics when they're visiting the island.
And final question, this is relating to the overall order paper for June Tynwald. I guess it demonstrates some level of confidence on the part of government that you've effectively handed the order paper over to backbenchers. There are no substantive motions down from government except for a few orders at the end of the order paper.
I think that's very much a timing issue. In fact, you get to this time of year. I mean, I think if you look at July, there is quite a busy government agenda for July. A lot of business has been compressed into July, obviously, how we're going to fit that all in is actually going to be the question. But I think it's just timing, really, Phil. There's a lot of reports and a lot of activity coming forward from a government perspective in next month's sitting.
That was Aaron Michael, MHK, Alf Cannon. Next, Onken MHK Julie Edge. You had the first question on the order paper, a starred question, and that was in relation to particularly the recommendations of the Everil inquiry and the response of government to that. I guess that means that you're not wholly convinced that government is doing everything it should be doing to protect children.
That's exactly it. I'm really concerned. We appear to be, I feel, going backwards. And the Everil report had lots of recommendations that was going to take us forward with children's services, and particularly around documentation keeping and, in the data held, etc. Certainly, as I said in the debate, when I worked at Ballacameen, I party to this report, and certainly the head teacher at Ballacameen did put forward, she gave evidence at the time, and it was hard work to get everything in place and ensure that everybody understood. People would challenge her all the time. You can't ask for that. Yes, we can. We need it on records. This is, it's got to happen. So I'm concerned, is that still happening? I don't think it probably is happening correctly in all places. And I'm also there was quite a big section in the report with regards to the Youth Justice Team, which I've sort of been picking up on most recently. And I know the Minister for Home Affairs has said they're working on it. It's actually the responsibility of the Department for Health and Social Care. And perhaps, you know, they could bring something forward quicker.
The one of the big concerns that probably, well, definitely has occurred since the Everil inquiry, of course, is the changed way in which young people interact with each other, particularly using social media, and all the risks that come from that. Well, I don't know. You tell me. Has government acknowledged that risk? Has it introduced things associated with the use of social media in terms of the way in which it helps or tries to help protect children?
Yeah, no, it hasn't. But when I was the Minister for Education, I raised with the Chief Minister very early on when the UK were talking about the Online Safety Bill. I straight away said we need to be part of this because cross-jurisdictional could happen with any events with our young people. And I was assured right up until not being the minister that a submissive extent clause had been requested. And most recently, I got the impression that that's definitely happened. I think we need to be ensuring that we're ready for this when it comes in the UK, and that the Isle of Man's sitting ready to go as well to protect our young people. I'm very concerned that we seem to have quite a lot of young people in the criminal system, and I'd rather see them not criminalised because that affects impacts their whole life, and looked after in a different way and a different approach, which is what the Everil reports was all about. It was a totally different approach. I'm concerned that maybe some of the professionals aren't even aware of the Everil report that are now working in our children's services, and that is a big concern. And we need to make sure it's appropriate for the Isle of Man and how we want to deal with our children, not bring into the island practices that are done in big cities in the UK. It doesn't work. We're a small island, small culture, and we need to be help and support all of our young people for the best future they can all have, no matter what their backgrounds or the issues that they may have.
Were you reassured by the answers that the Chief Minister gave you?
Not really. I got a big list of we've done this, we've done that. I can send you this. I think what I always aim to do with any questions is to try and get them to think differently. Oh my goodness, we perhaps haven't done this. We should have done this. I'm quite certain that there'll be various officers thinking, actually, we have stopped doing that. Should we have stopped doing that? Particularly around the Youth Justice Team. And, you know, people say, oh, why are you interested? I'm very interested in it because I didn't agree in it going in the first place. I've seen how well it operated when I worked at Ballycommune High School, and it supported a restorative justice approach for young people rather than criminalising them. Recently, I asked questions with regards to the secure unit, and, you know, we've got a secure unit for young people that's full. I'm not happy with that. I want to see that empty and young people having that better opportunity through a restorative justice approach.
That was Onchan MHK and former Education Minister Julie Edge. Next we hear from Arbury, Castletown and Maloo MHK Tim Glover.
You had two questions down, one to the Enterprise Minister, one to the Chief Minister in relation to the TT. If we start off with the message or the question to the Chief Minister, you were hoping that there would be some kind of messaging from our senior politicians in relation to welcoming visitors in the first instance and then saying farewell to the visitors towards the end of the TT fortnight. Do you think that's really the role of our senior politicians?
I do in this case, because we've got the most visitors to the island that we have at any other time of the year, and a simple welcome and a thanks for visiting towards the end has always been done in the past. I think it was a massive PR opportunity missed by central government.
Of course, if you are successful in persuading them to do this, this is going to be election year, isn't it, that they'll be doing it, because next year is obviously the next opportunity. Is that appropriate? Bearing in mind, you know, you've got a range of different people that the message is going to, not just the people coming to the island and those leaving.
Well, I've noticed as well, for example, in the programme we get now, there's no forward or welcome as there used to be. So it was just to see if central government is in some way trying to distance itself from the event. Now, I got that assurance and the Chief Minister took on board what I was saying and will reflect on it. So that's why I didn't really follow up with too many supplementaries after that. He'd agreed, I take your point.
Okay, and then we move to the question that you had to the Enterprise Minister. I think it was Rob Collister suggested that the Enterprise Minister can't be responsible for supplying a fortnight of beautiful sunny weather with no wind. It would be nice if he could, though, wouldn't it?
It would, but that is not in the gift of even a minister here on the Isle of Man. The point I was making was we've had 3 years now of this increased race schedule, and I think TT fans want to see racing, but are they getting what they actually want now? Because of this year's races, we lost the senior, and we also lost or had only one race that went the full race distance. Of course, they can't control the weather, but the 3 years have shown. Year one was glorious sunshine for the whole event. The last 2 years, it's been quite the opposite. And the last 2 years, I think, have demonstrated how little wiggle room there is within the schedule as it currently is.
And, of course, we all get senior race day off, or at least that's the bank holiday that we... That's the name we call the bank holiday at the end of TT week. But, of course, the senior race isn't on that day. Are you suggesting that maybe... there should be a rethink to ensure that the senior race is a little bit further up the calendar, and the two races that would have been on the Friday should now be on the Saturday instead.
2012 we lost the senior, and we've lost it for a second time this year in the entire history of the event. Now, when the TT was on the Friday, the reserve date was the Saturday all day. Now it's on the Saturday, the reserve day is a lot less, it's just Sunday afternoon. So there's, again, less wriggle room within the schedule, and the senior race is the one that everybody wants to see. It's the highlight of the whole week. So I was just highlighting what can be done to make sure that the senior is a little bit better protected than it currently is. It seems to be the most exposed race now in terms of being lost, potentially. So that was the point I was making there.
And I specifically asked, are you suggesting that maybe it should move to the Friday?
I think that there's quite a popular bandwagon out there for that. Yes, indeed there is. And the other concern I raised through that question, and it was a point that Douglas Central MHK Chris Thomas also picked up on, but more in a Douglas-centric way. As part of that consultation, looking back at this year's TT, are they going to be talking to local commissioners who particularly put events on during TT? Well, it's not the fortnight now, it's less than the fortnight. Ramsey don't have their sprint anymore, so is he going to talk to Ramsey commissioners? Is he going to talk to Peel and Port Erin, who have their specific TT days? Because from talking myself to them, the feedback I'm getting is that numbers were way down this year in, for those days.
And the Minister was very keen not to talk about numbers until all the detailed numbers come through. When are we expecting to have those detailed numbers? Because you would have thought, we are well past TT now. You'd have thought maybe they would have been able to add up how many people came on the boat and through the airport.
Yeah, I did ask that off the record with the minister there. They're expecting to start the full review in July. I wanted to get the question in while it's still fresh in everyone's mind, so we'll wait and see what comes out of that review now.
That was Tim Glover, MHK. Next, Douglas East, MHK, Joni Farragher.
If we go in chronological order, the first thing that you had was a question in relation to parts for jets. What was your concern with that?
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess I was just concerned whether or not the island might potentially be seen to be complicit following investigations that are being undertaken by international humanitarian organisations with regard to complicity in either ongoing or past war crimes or crimes against humanity. And as we are aware that the International Court of Justice is investigating some of the members of Israeli government and has a arrest warrant out for its president, or is it prime minister? I'm sorry, but for Netanyahu. I felt like it was an important point to raise that if the island does have potentially a part to play in what's happening in Gaza, that we can establish whether maybe there might be some protocols to put in place to ensure that that supply chain doesn't implicate us.
The Isle of Man, though, has or business on the Isle of Man has every right to produce parts and sell them, provided that those parts are being used for legitimate reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we can't really argue with the legality of it. I think where I was coming from was that actually sometimes something that's legal doesn't necessarily mean that it's ethically, morally correct, and doesn't necessarily mean that it sits within our obligations under international humanitarian conventions that we've signed up to. And I think, I guess, what I was getting at was, has there been any assessment of whether we are actually fulfilling our obligations under those conventions, such as the Geneva Convention and other bodies of international humanitarian law, and the responsibility that they place on all states. And regardless of whether the Chief Minister likes it or not, we actually are an independent parliament and have the obligation and the ability to check supply chains.
The Chief Minister made some fairly reasonable points, I thought, in relation to the Manx economy, and that we can't be having to second guess whether Tynwald views something as ethically okay or not okay. We just have to follow international law and rules and regulations that are set and just crack on. Businesses would become very stifled, I suppose, if they had to keep second guessing what the views of Tynwald might be in relation to ethics.
I can see that argument, but I think where I'm coming from here is that I have raised this. I'm not saying that we should necessarily check absolutely everything that happens, but I am asking this question, so therefore, can we check? Because we have a role to play. We have every single little voice counts. And as somebody the place that I'm speaking from is somebody who has studied government-sanctioned atrocities at master's level at university, and has studied in my specialist area was the Shoah or the Holocaust of the Third Reich, which I studied from the age of 16 up until the age of 22. That is long years of establishing the socio-economic reasons, the historical context, and what actually makes atrocities possible. And it is the fact that people remain silent. It is the functionaries, it's the bureaucrats, it's the people who think that actually it's not my place to question. That is how atrocities happen. It's important. Every single tiny little voice is important. I asked the question in order to find out if we could establish supply chains. It would seem from the Chief Minister's response that we can't.
So then we move on to the motions. You had two motions. The first was in relation to the family library. There were amendments. There was certainly an amendment from the Treasury Minister which suggested that maybe we need to just sit down with the directors of the family library and work out what's going wrong with the finances and try and help. What did you make of the debate?
I thought the debate was good, actually. I thought it was really interesting. I think this, I said a couple of times, and I genuinely do see a will to ensure that the services in the family library keep going. I don't think there's anybody in the court who disagreed with that. Like I said in the debate, I didn't support the amendment in the first instance. I voted against the Treasury Minister's amendment just purely because at the end there it seemed like saying that support services, there might be some that were being prioritised over others, and I actually think that the services and the community hub of the family library are just all equally important, and it's the whole thing, you know, it's the whole ethos and culture and staff and all of the services they provide under one roof, and I just think I would have been keen to see my original wording. However, now that that hasn't gone through, I still feel reasonably optimistic that we will continue to see work progressing in terms of trying to save the library, which is, I think, everybody's ultimate aim.
And of course, that is the issue, really, isn't it? I don't think there was a single member of Tynwald who didn't think it was a good idea to do something. And I think there were, was it questions last time in the May Tynwald? And I reasonably put the point to the listener. It's all right asking all these questions, but surely somebody should be finding the solutions. I guess that's what you've tried to do here.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what the solutions are at this stage, and that was what I was asking for the Council of Ministers to look more into this, to in recognition of the fact that we know that they are providing really quite vital community services and linking up a lot of issues and preventing a lot of issues down the line in terms of support that they provide for people. And I think it was just recognising that we need to get something to assist the library, how that looks and you know what that will look like when it comes back to Tynwald at the moment isn't really known, and I genuinely don't know. I was asking them to investigate what could be done, and that doesn't necessarily sit within government, but somebody needs to kind of, I guess, come in and say, look, how can we resolve this? So that was what I was trying to do.
And then the final motion that you had, I mean, you got support. The health minister actually seconded the motion. What was it you were looking for there?
So that was to try to get all age pathways for diagnosis and support for ADHD and autism, as well as bringing in the work of the other neuro minorities committee, dyslexia, dyscalculia, etc., and that was the Tynwald committee, and to look at the cost of not providing diagnosis and support for adults with neurodivergence. So, I think this work had been something that I was pushing quite. Heavily and positively, actually, in the department, but having not been in there for a little while, I've obviously seen a bit of a fall off of that, and I was just trying to get that work back on track. And I'm really, really pleased that the Health Minister, the Minister for Health and Social Care, and the staff within that department worked with me to try to come up with a motion that we could all support, which we did, and that she obviously seconded my motion, and then that received unanimous support. I think that does go to show people have been lobbying hard. We've all had a lot of emails on this matter. I've been inundated. I did say in the debate it's the single issue that I've received the most correspondence about, and we've had some extremely controversial, highly emotive issues that we've dealt with in this administration. I have been surprised at the amount of correspondence that I've received and the amount of people that this issue touches. So really, really hopeful that we are now getting back on track with getting that all age support and diagnosis pathways in for everybody.
And of course there are two ways to move a motion. The one way is to be to go all out for a fight and be quite aggressive about it, and the other way is to talk to the person whose help you need the most, work out a way in which you can frame your motion so that you get the most support.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that last way that you mentioned there is my favoured way to try to be collaborative, because the ultimate, I mean, from my perspective, my ultimate aim is to try and help as many people as possible with this motion, is to try to actually get that support in place for people who are past 18 and who suspect that they are neurodivergent but haven't been able to access any way to ascertain whether they're correct about that or not, and to really get that support and diagnosis pathways in there for them. So what is my best route to actually get that is the way that I think it, and I think if I go in there for the fight, I might not necessarily get the support of the council and ministers. There are 10 of them now, Phil. So it's important that we, you know, as far as I was concerned, to try to get that motion being successful, to just try and work in a collaborative way, which I prefer anyway.
That was Joni Farragher, MHK. Next, Vice Chair of the Public Sector Pensions Authority, Rob Collister, MHK.
Rob, you had a question to answer in Tynwald, and that was relating to what support you had given in relation to the local government pension scheme. And of course that is a scheme which has been becoming, I guess, quite difficult for local authorities to continue to support, because it has quite a significant employer's contribution to it. What level of support has your authority been able to give?
Well, back in 22-23, the Department of Infrastructure, the Minister at the time, asked if the Public Sector Pensions Authority Chief Exec would chair that group. That group was formed, and it was just to look at a work plan in order to look at savings and potential benefits from bringing forward those changes. They made a number of recommendations. To the best of my knowledge, those recommendations have not been implemented by the Department of Infrastructure. So that's where we are at the moment. You're absolutely right. There is anybody who works for a local authority on the island, they can access this scheme. And it's managed through Douglas City Council on their behalf by an external partner. So we are very much removed from the scheme. We were just asked in 2023-22 to come up and chair the group, have a look at it, make some recommendations, and for those recommendations to be brought back to the Department of Infrastructure, which is what I believe has happened.
And of course, the local authority pension scheme is the last bit of unreformed public pensions that remains the across government. A change was made because it was deemed that the pension scheme for government workers or pension schemes were unaffordable in the long term. The one public pension scheme that hasn't been touched as yet is that relating to local authorities.
Yeah, my colleague from Douglas Central, Mr. Thomas, made various statements in the chamber about potential savings up to £1 million. Obviously, we are slightly removed from this process. So he asked the direct question about, would this be better managed, maybe possibly within the Public Sector Pension Authority? I will certainly raise that question within the authority itself to see if there's any scope for that, or if this should stay outside of government and managed through the local authority on behalf of the members, but it managed again by an external partner. So there's a lot of questions to be asked. Unfortunately, as the vice chair, you know, that the pension sort of topic is one that really is difficult to get your head around. And even though I've been in post now for several months, I'm still finding my way around this and navigating. The very fortunate thing is we have some brilliant staff within the Public Sector Pensions Authority. And I wish Mr. Thomas had actually brought a very clear understanding of what he was trying to achieve. Because when we do discuss pensions, and we have thousands of workers, both in government and hundreds in local authority that can access this, it's really important that the information that we are putting in the public domain is accurate to benefit them, but also future people who use the schemes in the future.
You've also got two orders or regulations, whatever they are, on the order paper from the Public Sector Pensions Authority. What do those achieve?
Yes, yeah, so one of them relates to the Isle of Man Teachers Pension Scheme 2025. This is just a tidying up exercise. Remove the references relating to the Isle of Man and to the UK. It's nothing more than that. It has no real effect on the people that benefit from those schemes. It's just a tidying up exercise on that one. And the one item we have is item 12. It relates back in 2012 and 2014. We had a cleanup exercise where we started to bulk many of our pension schemes together. This again is just another one where we have, I think it's 57 members that are no longer active members. They are people who benefit from the scheme, so we can actually port that into another scheme in order to help save costs. Just to highlight where those costs would be saved, every pension scheme under the legislation has to produce a set of financial statements. If we can bulk it up and put it in with an existing scheme, then that will save significant costs both to the members and to the Public Sector Pensions Authority.
That was Onken MHK Rob Collister. Finally, Education Minister Daphne Kane MHK, who appears to be being thwarted by members of the Legislative Council.
Do you need to take members of the Legislative Council out for coffee, maybe buy them a cake or something? LegCo generally doesn't give government a bloody nose, it's fair to say, but every single time you seem to want to move an amendment, they don't seem to be willing to back the general view of Keys.
You'd have to ask them why that is, and perhaps we need to engage more with them. We have had a session that we put on for members last week. Perhaps there was a time that not everybody could attend, but certainly those who attended, I think, very definitely heard the passion from our head teachers and understood the system that we have, and also that actually the Isle of Man is building a quality assurance system that others are looking at with interest and could be world leading. Not saying it's perfect, not saying it's there, but we have had an extended pilot now for 2 years. We are developing the framework against which our schools are assessed. We are finalising that, just waiting for the last feedback, and then that will be published, and hopefully there will be greater understanding amongst members and also amongst parents and students as to how that process works and how all of this is aimed at ensuring that we get the best outcome for every individual learner, and we're putting in place the environment and the support that each individual learner needs to excel and to reach their potential, to have the best education journey that is possible within our school system.
And the reason I mentioned LegCo, of course, was because we had the not often used situation. There was a draw in the vote in LegCo, which meant that the president had to vote, and of course the president always votes with the Keys in those instances. And that was an amendment in relation to the employment of children. It was quite an amicable debate, I thought, and effectively a reasonably well put view was made that perhaps we're too cautious in the way we have our employment law relating to children.
Well, I think we're in line with the International Labour Organization guidance that children are able to work from the age of 13, and these regulations govern the type of work and the amount of work, the working hours that children can do up to the school leaving age of 16. And the regulations were last brought in 2018, and the department's recognised for some time that there are issues with them that we need to update. We are well on with a process of reviewing it. I shared with honourable members, and there weren't that many. I don't think there were that many from LegCo there, although Mrs. Kinnish was. The areas that the department is looking at, and we are engaging with key stakeholders, with our colleagues in the Department for Enterprise, to have the business and employers feedback into the process of what are causing issues and what are what where we need to make the tweaks on all those aspects. And likewise, we are very conscious that these affect young people, and it is the onus is on us to ensure that we engage with young people about their experience of getting paid work or otherwise, and for them what changes are needed to the regulations that are going to affect them in the future, and hopefully make it easier for them to find jobs and make employers more comfortable in offering jobs to young people who may be under 16. We know there are several opportunities on the island, but we know anecdotally that a job advertised for an under 16 had 300 applicants. So we think that, you know, there are certain things the department is listening to, the various feedback from both business, employers, the Department for Enterprise, and I'm happy to take on members' contributions today as well. We were taking notes throughout that. We will feed that into our thinking and discussions. And the reason it was very close, because I think a couple of the amendments, we're all on the same page, but my point was that the purpose of us going away and having a think holistically about all the employment of children regulations is in order that we address everything that we think needs reviewing in a considered way and bring back the regulations for approval in the autumn, by October if I can, but I didn't want that putting in as a set date if for any reason part of our consultation slips and means we can't deliver in October. But the definite ambition of the department is that we review all the employment for children regulations. We revise them. We come back. We have our new employment regulations drafted and guidance. And we come back at a sitting October or possibly November, but certainly by the end of the year, this year. And we hopefully win the Honourable Member's support so that new employment for children regulations can come into force from April next year, and that gives a time period then for employees and children who may be looking for these sort of jobs to be fully aware of the law and how it affects them, if for those wanting to find paid work before they're at the age of 16.
Because some of the examples, certainly, that were trotted out were, quite frankly, ridiculous. You know, that on a Sunday you were only allowed to work for 2 hours or something like this. Well, who's going to employ someone to work in a cafe for a couple of hours? They kind of need a bit longer than that.
There are restrictions on a school night. After school working is restricted to 2 hours currently, I think. We've had some feedback about potentially making an earlier start time. It's currently 7, but the school time has also moved forward. We've had some feedback that it's tricky, that young children between the age of 13 and 15 can only work 2 hours and then must have a 15-minute break and another 2 hours and a 15-minute break. Actually, we're looking at perhaps making combining the amount of time to 4 hours and having a half an hour break. There, we are listening to the feedback, and in terms of the recording of young people's, but actually the department's coming from this, from a safeguarding and looking after the welfare of children, and the onus is on us to ensure that any changes we make, we protect the children. We don't want anybody becoming overtired or overstretched or not exhausted and not able to learn during school time, and that's where the particular restrictions are over. But absolutely, I think while I didn't want everything to be prescribed that you will change this or you won't change that or you will change this aspect only and you'll do it by July, that's just not feasible. And we are going away and having a really good sit down and diligently going through the regulations with all the feedback that we can receive from it, from businesses, from employers, from the DfE acting in that regard, and also importantly from children. If we can achieve that with some targeted groups by the end of the year, we will. We're not thinking that this is a consultation that is appropriate to go on the consultation hub. This is very definitely about seeking views that to be fair, we've already had quite a number conveyed to us about the workability of the employment for children regulations, and we are looking to balance the practicalities of that with the protection, safeguarding welfare of the young people that the employment for children regulations covers.
And it's still, even getting things through for April next year, in force in time for April next year, that's still quite an ambitious timetable, because there is lots involved in doing this consultation, making sure you've fully considered everything. And of course, it's the classic case with being a minister, isn't it? If you hurry the hurdles and get something wrong, you'll be blamed for it. And if you take your time and get it right, you'll be accused of taking too long.
I couldn't agree more. And our job is, again, to balance the feedback that we've had from employers about the flexibility, about the working hours, about the recording of young people's, under the age of 16, paid work, the practicalities of that balanced against looking after their welfare to ensure that we don't have any adverse impact on their education, the school hours. That's all in the mix, and we will work through it, and we look forward to bringing revised regulations back before Tynwald as soon as we are ready to do that.
Garth MHK Daphne Kane there. So what do you think? Are current rules too restrictive with regard to child employment? Is it important for children to experience work, and do they need to be protected from unscrupulous employers? Does government adequately protect vulnerable children, and is enough resource available to give them good quality care? And should our political leaders be welcoming visitors to the TT? Let me know your thoughts on the programme by contacting Phil Gorn at manxradio.com and get in touch if you have any ideas for future shows. Don't forget, this programme is available as a podcast on Manx Radio's website. I'm Phil Gorn. Goramayos and Geisachrom. Thanks for listening.